Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Stonehenge, Glastonbury and beyond. The rise and fall of the peace convoy with Brig Ubridge. He was the organiser of the Big Green Gathering, some called the Brig Green Gathering, which picked up where the Peace Convoy and the Stonehenge Festivals left off. This week, part one, where we go up to the 1985 Battle of the Beanfield. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, the Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you've got someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
My name's Brig Ubridge. I first got interested in Stonehenge, I suppose, when I was a kid and I visited it with my parents back in the days when all there was in the way of a visitor centre was a little wooden hut, and I think it cost about sixpence to go in and visit. But then I first attended Stonehenge at Midsummer in 1970, back before the days of the Free Festival. But nevertheless, on Midsummer's Eve, there was always a huge crowd of people around Stonehenge who were allowed into the field where the stones actually are, but there was a barbed wire entanglement all around the stones and military police with dogs on the inside.
Well, hang on, because I can remember going in the 60s. In fact, I think I've even got a photograph sitting cross-legged on one of the stones. You know, that didn't seem to be, I mean, maybe this is maybe 67, something like that. I don't think there was anything around the stones. You could just walk straight up to them and sit on them, play around them.
Well, by 1970, there was a barbed wire entanglement all the way around, in a circle around the stones. And, as I say, military police with dogs on the inside. I think they may have had some trouble with some of the squaddies going down there on Midsummer and getting a bit out of order.
So what sort of a gathering was it before the Stonehenge Festival started?
It was all sorts of people, sort of hippie element and people in cloaks sitting there with drums through the night. Lots of local people, some squaddies from the local army camps. A whole collection of all sorts of people. A couple of thousand or so.
And the idea was to try and see the sunrise.
Yes, and then the so-called druids in their white sheets would come out before dawn, and there was a lot of barracking of that, people going, well, they've got no rights, they're not genuine druids, and so on, why do they get special treatment, and everyone else on the outside of the barbed wire.
So that's quite interesting, isn't it? So there were sort of official druids on the inside and maybe unofficial ones on the outside.
Well, yes, insofar as anyone can be an unofficial druid.
Well, because there are lots of different people who call themselves We Are the True Orders, aren't they?
Well, there are no true orders. They were wiped out by the Romans. So anyone can... the druids who had the rites given them at Stonehenge at that time in the 60s and 70s had actually been formed, I think, about 1911 or possibly the 19th century, but they didn't go back all that far. In the following years, I did spend one winter down in Cornwall, so I passed back and forth up the 303, hitchhiking back and forth between London and Cornwall quite a few times that winter. I mean, that route and that vision, that wonderful sight that you get of Stonehenge when you come from the London direction over the top of the hill and you see Stonehenge spread out before you, is part of our national cultural heritage. You know, it's part of our visual heritage that, amongst other things, I'm concerned that we're going to lose if we get this Stonehenge tunnel built and the road diverted. And I think it's actually part of what underlies the the appeal of Stonehenge is that so many people see it in passing and then go, oh, well, we must go and visit that.
Well, this is what officialdom would say the opposite, probably, wouldn't they? They'd say, well, actually, by burying the road, it means that the monument actually is not cluttered with cars, this sort of thing.
But it also means that by diverting the road, no one can even see it unless they walk to it, or unless they go and pay 20 quid to English Heritage to go and see it. They've got a monopoly, and a big money-making monopoly, on anyone even seeing it, even from a distance.
Because I understand in the 1950s, the cranes came in and they started putting various plinths and bits and pieces of it, putting it back together, because they realised that certain parts of it had fallen down. I suppose the lintels from the very top parts had fallen, and a lot of people don't realise that it got a makeover in the 50s, and I'm not sure how accurate that was to the original Stonehenge.
Well, neither am I. I'm not an archaeologist. You'd have to talk to archaeologists, of whom there are very many distinguished archaeologists who've worked on Stonehenge over the years, and they're all opposed to digging the tunnel.
Okay, so what about the first three festivals there?
Well, there was a camp at Stonehenge in 1974, in the summer of 1974. I wasn't there, but it hit the newspapers. They called themselves the Wallies, the group who camped there. They were there for Midsummer in the way that I had been in 1970, but they actually set up camp in the field and refused to move off. And the way the law stood at the time for English Heritage to get an eviction notice on them, they had to actually name them on the court papers. So the people who were camping there decided that they would all be called Wally. So everyone who was summoned to appear in the High Court to answer this eviction charge said their name was Wally. I think it was about 100. So it became known as the Wally Camp. But those people from the Wally Camp were then at the People's Free Festival in Windsor Great Park that year, which was the third such People's Free Festival in Windsor Great Park, the Queen's Back Garden. And that was something which was set up by anarchist squatters in London and so on as a free festival, a kind of reaction to the commercial pop festivals of the time. And it went on for 3 years. The last one was in 74. And in 74, after the Bank Holiday Monday, when the police came free from policing the Reading Festival, which was going on at the same time, the police moved in on it and violently shifted everybody off Windsor Great Park. I was there running a free food kitchen at the free festival at the time, so I was one of the thousands of people who were moved off Windsor Great Park then, and we actually moved the remnants of the free food kitchen up to Stonehenge. There was a kind of refugee camp of people who'd been moved off Windsor Great Park, which then convened at Stonehenge on the edges of the byway that made a triangle, still does, of the field that's actually owned by English Heritage. And we were there from about the 1st of September through till about the end of September, when gales drove people off, and some of them set up a squat in Amesbury for a while. That was actually where I met the mother of my two sons, but that's another story. But I suppose that helped give me an emotional tie to Stonehenge as well. So the idea came about that seeing as we weren't being allowed to have a free festival at Windsor Great Park anymore, it would be good to have a free festival at Stonehenge. And so the first Stonehenge Free Festival happened in 1975. And I was there running a free food kitchen again. And it carried on throughout the 70s and into the 80s.
Now, one problem always must be when you get large numbers of people together to do something like that, problems with illegal activity going on, whatever, drug dealing, this sort of thing, maybe violence where there's no police around. I mean, this is one of the big fears, and maybe it's more of a fear than a reality that, you know, when large numbers of people get together, you get a kind of lawlessness.
Well, I think what happened with Stonehenge and Stonehenge Free Festival was that it did become too lawless, if you like, due to the initial attitude of the police, which was that they stood back. And throughout the 70s, it was a fairly low-key and nice event. But because it became known as a place where there was no policing on site, that did allow certain elements to come in, and it did get a bit out of hand towards the end. But, you know, back in the 70s, no one really cared about cannabis. Nobody still does. And it was only in the 80s that we started to get a big rise in the amount of hard drugs in society in general.
And that's heroin, cocaine, that sort of thing.
That sort of thing. That manifested at Stonehenge because it was a kind of lawless environment. But it was manifesting in all the inner cities in Britain at the same time. It wasn't peculiar to Stonehenge. And those of us who'd been prominent, if you like, in being part of the Stonehenge Free Festival, and I don't say organising because no one organised the Stonehenge Free Festival. It was all self-organised. Everyone organised themselves, and everyone did it on the principle of the festival is what you bring to it.
I mean, drugs are one problem, and, you know, it might be that it would only affect the person that's taking them if they're having a bad time on the drugs or whatever. But, I mean, how does a large bunch of people like that at a free festival deal with violence? That's another thing. If people start kicking off against each other.
Well, generally by pressure of a lot of people gathering around and saying, no, no, calm down, calm down. But there was trouble at Stonehenge from time to time. You know, some biker gangs in particular caused a bit of trouble. And actually, by the early 80s, 83, 84, it had got to be a place that you didn't necessarily want to take your kids to.
What about the positive side, though? I mean, the music, you know, what kind of things, cultural things, were going on at the festival?
Well, the music was very good, a lot of it. Hawkwind always played, and the Here and Now band and so on. They were sort of anarchistic bands that like to play for free at the free festival. It was a very positive, kind of creative kind of thing that you created the festival by what you brought to it. People wanted to have a good time, have a festival, have the kind of creative things that we see now in Glastonbury Festival. If you look at Glastonbury Festival and all the creative stuff that goes on there in terms of all sorts of visual arts and theatre, street theatre and all that sort of thing. It was all happening back in Stonehenge in the 70s and early 80s.
I suppose the idea is this kind of open mic as well, where almost anyone can turn up knowing that they're going to get on a stage and do their thing.
Absolutely, and it made space for up-and-coming musicians and performers to find an audience.
I mean, in the 80s, of course, you've got the Glastonbury Festival and Stonehenge going on in parallel. Well, not quite in parallel, but what was the relationship between the two?
Not quite in parallel, and Glastonbury was for people who could afford the tickets, so it was kind of a little bit more middle class than Stonehenge, and Stonehenge was for the people who needed to go to something free, and particularly in the 80s, with the vast increase in unemployment that went on when Margaret Thatcher got in and cut all the subsidies that were keeping jobs together during the late 70s, and unemployment rocketed, went from 1 million to 3 million in a couple of years when Margaret Thatcher got in, and there were riots in the cities and so on. There were a lot more poor people who decided to come to Stonehenge, and it coincidentally, one of those years, I don't remember if it was 80 or 81, but one of those years, the summer solstice actually coincided with a weekend. So vastly more people came, and it went from being a festival of 6,000 or 7,000 people, as it had been through, as it had gradually built up to through the 70s to the end of the 70s, it suddenly went in one year from that to being 20,000 plus. At that point, it got a little bit more dodgy.
I mean, was there ever any understanding by Wiltshire Police that maybe they should have a kind of fairly low-key presence, so that they weren't there to maybe to arrest somebody for cannabis, but if there was anything more serious going on, that they might? Because that's what the way that it seems to work now at places like Glastonbury and other festivals nowadays, is the police are there, but it's a very low-key. So that wasn't really happening in the 80s, is that what you're saying?
Well, what happened at Stonehenge was that the police were there on the outside of the festival, but didn't, unless they were coming in undercover, and we've learnt a lot in the past few years about undercover policing and what was going on in those days. But unless they were doing it undercover, they weren't actually coming in on the festival site. That there was a police station down in the car park of the monument itself. So they had a sort of arm's length attitude towards it, and they were actually afraid that if they came on site, then people in a large mass would confront them and drive them off site again.
So what have you learnt about undercover police in those days? I mean, we know quite a lot more about more recent stuff, I suppose, from the noughties, but what about in those days? Do you know what they were up to?
Well, we know that the undercover policing stuff started in the late 60s. We still have a lot to find out, and there's the Pitchford inquiry going on at the moment, which is supposed to be finding out what went on. But we know that between the late 60s and the early 2000s, there were actually hundreds of undercover police employed, and we only know the identities of about 24 of them, I think, at the moment. So there's an awful lot still to be found out. But certainly during the Thatcher years, during the 80s, there were an awful lot of people who were regarded by the government as being the enemy within. That was actually a phrase that Margaret Thatcher used. And that covered the peace movement, the CND and the peace camps and Greenham Common and so on. It covered the trades unions, and to an extent it covered hippie anarchists as well. There was some overlap.
Well, you're talking about an increase in trouble during the 80s at Stonehenge. Do you think any of that's put down to a by agent provocateurs? Because we certainly know more recently that there have been police, you know, big marches in London, things like that, have had agent provocateurs attached.
It could have been. One really has no evidence at the moment to point a finger and say that incident was caused by an agent provocateur. But it's not beyond the bounds of possibility at all. I actually tried to get recognised as an accredited participant in the Pitchford inquiry because of my involvement in the Big Green Gathering, of which I was a director from the early 90s through till 2009, because that was closed down by the police in 2009. And shortly afterwards, we found out that one of the people who was very prominent in running our main on-site bar, which was raising funds for climate change actions, was Mark Kennedy, one of these undercover police. He was actually the transport manager of our main bar that was called the Last Chance Saloon. And he was passing information to ACPO, the Association of Chief Police Officers, and the impetus to close down the Big Green Gathering, although it had been running for 16 years and was fully licensed and compliant with its license conditions and so on. That came from the Chief Constable of Avon and Somerset at the time. But so far, we haven't been successful in getting accreditation to the Pitchford Inquiry, so that hasn't gone any further. And there's a lot there that we'd like to find out the truth of, what information was actually being passed and how far that was what contributed to what happened to the Big Green Gathering. So I've tried to be involved on that level, but so far without success.
I mean, with things like the Stonehenge Festival, the Green Gathering, what threat do you think they represent? Why do the establishment are afraid of these things? Why?
Well, I suppose the establishment is always a bit afraid of people who are out of control, not following the rules, not fitting in with the way society would like them to be. Our rulers feel uncomfortable and feel threatened, quite often out of all proportion to how much threat people do pose.
Going back to the relationship between Stonehenge and Glastonbury, one's before the other, I think, isn't it?
Well, the Stonehenge Festival, by the 80s, it had grown to be something that went on for the whole of the month of June, because in order to invade the surrounding fields that were farmed and owned by the National Trust and rented out to a local farmer, people started arriving earlier and earlier to be there before the gates were padlocked and people were there to stop them. And so the start of it gradually crept earlier and earlier until it was running for the whole of June. Glastonbury Festival decided to have its weekend on the weekend immediately after the solstice. So that was around the 22nd of June or thereabouts. So, I mean, there would be quite a lot of people who would turn up at Stonehenge and then go on to Glastonbury or go down to Glastonbury just for that weekend and then come back to Stonehenge. But Stonehenge tended to mop up the people who couldn't afford to go to Glastonbury. I mean, some of the people who went to Stonehenge were actually then doing things at Glastonbury and actually taking part of the show to Glastonbury and had tickets for that reason. But it was only after Stonehenge was closed down, the Free Festival was closed down, that Michael Eavis started having much more trouble with people trying to get into Glastonbury without tickets and so on, and eventually had to build the mega fences and security that they have now.
I mean, you know, a cynical person would look at it and say, well, in a way, Glastonbury was providing an opportunity for people to do a Stonehenge, but with a kind of paywall around it. And I know, I don't know what year it first started, but the Glastonbury Festival was Arabella Churchill's brainchild.
She was certainly involved with it, and she was really the person behind the theatre field at Glastonbury. That was her part of the... There's a bridge now on the site there that's named after her, Arabella's Bridge. And she was a big part of the organisation of Glastonbury Festival and of making it more than just a pop festival, making it a general arts festival that included theatre and circus and all sorts of other things.
That seems to jar a little bit, what with Winston, you know, the... Okay, so there's a whole bunch of people that think Winston Churchill's a fantastic, you know, wonderful chap that won the Second World War for us all. But then there's another side to him, which is him after the Second World War being kept off the BBC because he kept talking about wanting to nuke Moscow and this kind of thing. So he's a very controversial character, certainly seemed to be doing all sorts of dodgy deals with Roosevelt and Stalin, stitching up Poland, all these kinds of things. Saw himself as a sort of globalist, I suppose, trying to run things and use the Second World War to his advantage. But what does Arabella Churchill, his daughter, then creating this wonderful festival, doesn't seem to fit somehow?
Well, I didn't personally know Arabella, so there's not all that much I can say. But if we're talking about Churchill, there's another side to him before the Second World War as well, because he was a government minister through the 1920s. He was Home Secretary during the general strike in 1926. He sent the troops into the coal mines. He's not remembered in South Wales, he's not remembered in the same sycophantic way as he is where he's remembered only for being the leader in the Second World War. There's still a lot of bitterness amongst people whose memories go right back to the general strike. And he was quite ruthless then in helping to put down the general strike. But by the same token, he was also an old drunk who liked a good time. So, I can't claim to be an expert on him.
Well, I was just thinking, I was reading recently that Adolf Hitler had said that when he took over Britain, he wanted Blenheim Palace, the Churchill family home, to be his headquarters when he wanted to move in, which does maybe imply that he felt that he was some part of some sort of aristocracy. But anyway, we're getting off the topic, really. And I suppose during the spring and summer and autumn, was there a sort of a series of regular, right, we're going here, now we're going here, we're going... I mean, was there? Did a kind of pattern develop of where the convoy went during the year?
A bit of one. I mean, the centre point was always Stonehenge. There would sometimes be a festival around the end of May, before Stonehenge, probably around the May bank holiday weekend. Someone had set one up somewhere. So people would then go from there to Stonehenge. And then from Stonehenge would be the biggest convoy of the summer, because that would be where the largest number of people had gathered. They developed a bit of a pattern. I mean, for a few years, the convoy from Stonehenge went off to a place near Yate, near Bristol, Ingleston Common, and put on a little festival there. There was one year, it must have been 78, it went to Glastonbury area. In fact, in 77, there was a free festival that occurred in Glastonbury area on the 7th of the 7th, 77. And the following year, people from Stonehenge said, well, that was nice being down Glastonbury way last year, we'll go down that way again. And went from Stonehenge down to Glastonbury area, and the police actually diverted them onto Michael Evis's land at Worthy Farm. Wouldn't let them go anywhere else. And Michael said, this is all a bit of a shock. Couldn't you come back next year? Because we're planning to restart the Glastonbury Festival next year. He actually ended up with a free festival on his land the year before he was planning for it, because the police had shepherded everybody onto his land in 78. And I think probably 79 and 80 and 81 were Ingleston Common. But there were a number of sites around that people went to, and it did vary from year to year.
So sometimes the police directing you, sometimes you're going where you want, and other times the police just coming, storming in and saying, get out of here.
Well, the police had to operate within the law, to an extent at any rate, and they had to do what they could actually cope with, because there aren't infinite numbers of police available at the drop of the hat to deal with a lot of people, even if they're driving dodgy vehicles or have grounds of that they could be stopped for suspicion. How do you stop 100 vehicles without causing chaos and blocking all the roads, and where do you put them, and so on? You know, people have to, they'd have to plan to do something like that. You can't just stop them with two police cars in the middle of the night. So, for example, when this convoy went in 78 down to Glastonbury area, they thought, oh, well, we know what we'll do. We'll send them down to Michael Eavis, get them off the road, and decide what we do with them from there. So that was the sort of thing that happened.
How do 100 different drivers of 100 different vehicles reach a decision about where they're going?
They follow the one in front.
Do the convoy literally have a vehicle at the front, and the person driving that vehicle made a decision about where the convoy is going?
I think that's generally how it happened, yes. They might know where they're making for in the first place. They probably would, and then that may have been something that was discussed among quite a lot of people beforehand. But one at the front would be leading the way. That's inevitable.
You've been talking quite a lot about Stonehenge. To what extent was there any kind of serious pagan interest in the whole sort of what Stonehenge represents religiously, or was it just a focus for attention, or both?
People felt, and I think were right to feel, that Stonehenge is part of our heritage and belongs to all of us. You know, in fact, it was left to the nation because it was felt that it was part of our heritage that belonged to all of us. There's some interest in the, you know, having the mock druids who came and did their thing at Midsummer focused attention on it being some kind of a temple, some kind of a religious site. And in a post-religious and scientific age, a lot of people look for some kind of spiritual or deeper significance to their lives. And actually, insofar as Stonehenge is a kind of observatory that marks the passing of the seasons and the solstices and the phases of the moon and so on, and we do understand that it does that, and it is some kind of celestial calendar in the arrangement of the stones, there's a kind of pagan significance in marking that and being in some way connected to the passage of the seasons, the position of the earth in the heavens, and it's the passage of the earth around the sun that actually provides us with all the energy on earth and keeps us as human beings in, and all creation on earth as a living entity. It powers the ecosphere, if you like. So there's a kind of meeting between a spiritual need and a scientific reality that, you know, it fits with a kind of modern paganism where one can feel there's something holy about the position of this blue planet in space that happens to support life because of where it is and the way that it goes around the sun. So, to a greater or lesser extent, people came to identify with that kind of perspective that took in the need for a spiritual dimension in their lives and the reality of nature and the cosmos. Throughout history, the downtrodden people who've been repressed in one way or another by the ruling classes have from time to time found their own way, successful or unsuccessful, of fighting back in some way. And the history that has taken us from feudalism to some kind of democracy is a continuum in which the power of the ruling classes has been gradually nudged back slightly by people's rebellions from below. And it's happened all over this country and in many other countries as well.
Can you tell us when it was that Stonehenge was stopped and how it happened, what happened?
Well, the last Stonehenge festival that happened was in 1984. And that one was too out of control for the authorities to ignore anymore, I think. There was a police porter cabin in the car park of the monument that actually got tipped over by people from the festival. At that point, I think the police and the authorities said, no, something has to be done. And then in 1985, well, during the winter of 84-85, I had been part of a peace camp at Molesworth in Cambridgeshire, which was scheduled to become the second cruise missile base in Britain after Greenham Common. Greenham Common was already up and running. It was a huge escalation in the nuclear arms race. It meant that there would be cruise missiles deployed in Britain that could be fired off the back of lorries. The lorries were going to be based at Greenham Common, just off the M4, and at Molesworth in Cambridgeshire, just off the A1. The plan was that when a nuclear war was going to break out, those missiles would disperse so that they couldn't be targeted by the Russians because they wouldn't know where they were. And they were intermediate range missiles so that they would arrive very quickly in Russia and Eastern Europe. And they were supposed to be very, very accurate so that they would be able to take out the Russian missiles before they could be fired. They were really a first strike weapon. Or they were certainly seen as such by the Russians, and that's what added so much to the tensions at the time of the nuclear arms race. And they were very, very much opposed by people in Britain, by the peace movement, and so there was the women's peace camp set up at Greenham Common in 1981, and a number of other peace camps set up at other bases around the country, including one at Molesworth. And in 1984, there was a green gathering took place at Molesworth that actually invaded the base. Molesworth at that time was a kind of disused Second World War air base. It had a compound in the middle of it, which at that time was used by the US forces in Britain for storing redundant equipment. And every year they would have an auction off a load of army surplus stuff there. But the rest of the site, which was a few square miles of Cambridgeshire, was actually deserted and not used and had no outside fence. So we decided didn't have another site for a green gathering that year, and decided that we would have a green gathering there at Molesworth. And so that was a kind of festival that invaded the MOD land there. And after the festival, various of us stayed on over the winter and became the Molesworth Rainbow Village. And we were living in tents and trucks and teepees and so on through the winter. And the following February, 6th of February, on a full moon, we were evicted by Michael Heseltine, who was Minister of Defence at the time, and 3,500 troops and police. It was the biggest job by the Royal Engineers since the crossing of the Rhine in 1944, so they said. And so they evicted the peace camp from the MOD land and put up a big barbed wire fence all the way around it in one night. I think it was a 7-mile perimeter that they fenced in one night. So I was there. I was part of that. I was thrown off Molesworth by Mr. Heseltine, who turned up in the morning after it had all gone on through the night. Came down by helicopter wearing a flak jacket and was pictured for the newspapers and so on. And it was front page in all the papers and so and everything. Those of us who were thrown off on that night became a kind of flying squad, an irritant around the Molesworth area for 2 or 3 months afterwards, through till Easter, which had been scheduled as a big national CND demonstration at Molesworth. So we were buzzing around and camping where we could. One or two other ex-air bases and reservoir and one or two laybys and so on around the area. We were buzzing around through until Easter. And it was after that when I and a few other remnants of that camp were actually parked up in Milton Keynes, through CND and Green CND, which was a specialist section of CND for green people, we were approached by someone from the National Trust, from the National Council of the National Trust, and asked to go to a meeting with National Trust and English Heritage about Stonehenge, because English Heritage and National Trust were taking out High Court orders to stop the Stonehenge festivals. They figured that I had some kind of connection with the Stonehenge people. And so I got invited to this meeting at the English Heritage headquarters, I think it was, or either that or National Trust. But there was Angus Stirling from English Heritage, Dame Jennifer Jenkins from National Trust, and various other functionaries. And they were saying, unfortunately, we can't do anything about Stonehenge because it's all been taken out of our hands by the police. They were feeling powerless and a bit nervous about what was going to happen at Stonehenge. And sure enough, when people went for Stonehenge on June the 1st, there were vast amounts of police waiting for them. This is 1985, and they got diverted into a field by a police roadblock, and then all their vehicles were smashed up and 500 people arrested. They had people in police cells all over the south of England. I hadn't actually gone on that expedition because there were a few of us who could see what was going to happen, and we were sitting in Savernake Forest saying, no, we've got a good site here for a few days in Savernake Forest, let's just stay here and let them waste all their money on mounting a big operation on the wrong day. But fortunately there were people like the Earl of Cardigan who went along, and various journalists who went along and saw what happened. And there were TV cameras and so on in there who saw what happened with the police smashing everybody's vehicles up and behaving very roughly with the people who they hauled off. And it was known as the Battle of the Beanfield. That was how they stopped Stonehenge Festival happening.
Put this in its political context. You've also got Wapping, the miners' strike, this kind of thing going on. Almost every summer, something was happening in the Thatcher years to take out one of these big social movements.
Yes, well, the miners' strike had been 84, 85, so that finished in the spring of 85. By that time, there were all these paramilitary police squads that had been working in the coal fields, and it was just another example of that they drafted in paramilitary police squads from all over the country to deal with Stonehenge that summer.
The idea of people sort of travelling en masse in vehicles, were you doing that as well?
Not so much myself, but I know what was going on. It actually started from the squats. I was in the early 70s, I was in, or the mid 70s, I was living in a squatters community in West London, in Twickenham, because in those days, you know, it was more difficult to get rid of squatters. They made it easier and easier, but there were lots of places where there were vast areas that had been cleared out of people and held for redevelopment, stood empty for years, and people had nowhere to live, squatted them. And this community that I was in Twickenham was one of those. The developers, who were Bovis Construction, gradually managed to get people out of one house after another, and as soon as they did, they would demolish the house. So it was like a mouth that had lost half its teeth, the street in the end. You know, it was patches of waste ground in between these houses. People realised that actually they could buy up old buses or old trucks and stay within the community, living in a bus or a truck in between the houses. And that went on for a while, and those same people would take their buses and trucks off to festivals in the summer, because if you're living in a truck, it's easy to take you home with you. And people started going from one festival to another. All the people in trucks would go in a group, because that meant that they had mutual aid. Someone broke down, someone else would stop and help them, so on. And some people who had dodgy vehicles without an MOT on them or so on would be perhaps less likely to be stopped if they were in a group. That whole thing developed into the convoy, what was known as the convoy. It only became known as the peace convoy after it went from Stonehenge one year to Greenham Common. I think that would have been 1982. The women had already set up the peace camp at Greenham Common. At the end of Stonehenge Festival, there was always the question, well, where are we going next, folks? And someone suggested, well, we should go and support the women at Greenham Common. So rather than just being a convoy of people looking for another festival, it went with a bit of a purpose to it. Somebody produced a stencil that said Peace Convoy, and people stenciled Peace Convoy onto the side of their trucks and went off to Greenham Common. Knocked down the fence with sledgehammers, caused a bit of a ruckus. That didn't receive much publicity, but thereafter, wherever those trucks went, all sorts of, I think probably grossly overblown stories started appearing about this dreadful peace convoy that had been rampaging around the country and that had been deliberately spilling oil out of the back of the vehicles to make following police cars skid and crash, and all sorts of weird stories like that appeared in the tabloid.
Any truth to that?
Not so far as I'm aware, no. It just sounds like good stories for blackening people's names, and the name was blackened as the Peace Convoy.
I can imagine, you know, you could actually take up quite a lot of space on the road with a convoy like that.
You could, you know, 150 vehicles, something like that. Trucks, coaches, one or two double-decker buses. You know, vehicles that were big enough to convert into a living space. So anything from a tranny van upwards to a double-decker bus.
But you can imagine something as heavy as a lorry or a bus, it's not going to fare very well on a field.
No, but if you've got enough of them, then you've got enough to tow people off. You know, so some people started getting specialist vehicles, ex-army vehicles and so on, that were capable of towing other vehicles off fields if need be.
What about running repairs?
Well, amongst those people who did that, people who were into trucks, a lot of them were mechanics of one sort or another and got better and better at it and would do these things collectively together. So it was possible to do it. I mean, the most fantastic patching up that happened was after the bean field in 1985, because there was a group of people who'd stayed behind in Savernake Forest and hadn't gone on the run to Stonehenge on June the 1st. That meant that when the 500 people who'd been arrested were then bailed out because they couldn't keep them forever in police custody, the police had to release all these vehicles that they'd impounded that had been smashed up one way or another. People then brought them back to the camp at Savernake Forest, and in the following week did an awful lot of patching up so that they could actually go on the road again. And when there was a High Court order for people to get out to Savernake Forest, you know, all this had been on the news and had caused a great kerfuffle, and the police weren't going to do it again. So there was actually a negotiation that went on with the police to allow people to drive out of Savernake Forest with these dodgy vehicles and go somewhere else. These vehicles that had been smashed up with the intention of making them undrivable and unserviceable, most of them had been patched up in some way that they could get back on the road, even though some of them didn't have windscreens and didn't have windows and so on.
It's interesting that you've got someone from the aristocracy that almost like sided with the convoy rather than the establishment. I mean, how did that happen? Who was this character?
Well, Lord Cardigan was actually the landowner of the land at Savernake Forest, where people had gathered together the night before going for Stonehenge. He was aware of what had been happening. You know, there was this big encampment of people on his land who were going to go for Stonehenge. And he actually rode along the following day on a motorbike, went down to see what was going on, and saw all the vehicles being smashed up by the police in the field, in the so-called bean field. He was outraged by it and very outspoken about it, and so he was interviewed and on the television news and so on, and was very supportive, because although he didn't necessarily want all these people on his land, he certainly didn't want to see British people being beaten up by the police in that way.
That was Brig Ubridge, part one of our Stonehenge, Glastonbury and Beyond, the rise and fall of the peace convoy. Part two in the next few weeks. That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guest, that's Brig Ubridge, and also to studio engineer Joss Chivers. Dialects Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. They're on 0117 909 6897. Also online at prsc.org.uk. If you've got any of your precious spare time you can spend, you can volunteer it with us or with hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.